Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hey everybody, this is Cale Clark. Thanks for joining me today for another episode of The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. We're going through the book of Exodus right now, and we're looking at what's called the Book of the Covenant. This is really where the Ten Commandments are expanded upon, what's called the case law of ancient Israel. How do you expand the commandments to deal with different situations, different incidents that might come up? And this takes a lot of wisdom. This takes a lot of insight, and God gives it to people in Israel so that they can do just that. Now, the scholar Peter Enns, in one of his books called How the Bible Actually Works, he talks a little bit about how biblical laws can be ambiguous unless we're given further direction. And he gives a somewhat humorous example. He says, when my family goes away for a few days, and I ask someone to take care of our menagerie of dogs, cats, and rabbits, which at one point numbered as many as seven, I, the family administrator, leave instructions that could be used to illustrate one or more diagnoses in the DSMV. So here's what he would say to somebody looking after his pets. In the morning, the dogs need to go out between 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock, depending on how late you let them out the night before. Give them each one cup of dry food mixed with 1.5 tablespoons of wet food and a dash of water to create more gravy. Place the bowls on opposite sides of the kitchen so they don't get distracted. When you let them out, keep it to 5 minutes if you're not outside with them, but make it longer if you are, unless it's overly humid and or hot. When they come in, they get a snack. The chicken treats in the morning, biscuits in the afternoon, and those teeth cleaning things that look like toothbrushes in the evening. All three boxes are on the fridge in order. Check their water twice a day, and if it is less than half full, fill it. Now the cats. You'll notice two types of food on the shelf on the right side along the basement stairs, and it goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on for two pages, single-spaced. These are the instructions that he gives those taking care of his pets while he's away. So the point of it is he can't just say, hey, please take care of our pets. He's got to give them further direction. And just like when he says, when his kids were younger, he used to tell them, clean your room, or I'll banish you to the Phantom Zone for all eternity. Well, not really, but the first question he got from his kids was this, what do you mean by clean? What do you mean by clean? And so there needs to be a bit more explanation happening. And that's the reason, a very humorous illustration for why we need this case law. And we have it in the Catholic Church as well. How do you apply the commandments? How do you apply the law of God, the gospel, to different situations? All right, let's look back now, pick up where we left off in Exodus chapter 21. And we talked about how these are community laws, and the community had to enforce them together because it takes a community to raise a person, it takes a community to keep order in the community, and it also takes a community to judge cases that come up. That's why there were judges in each town, the judges of Israel. They would meet at the city gates, and they would look at each of these individual cases and talk about guilt, innocence, how do we deal with this? And we left off talking about laws regarding oxes, animals, that oxen that people would keep. What happens if one gets loose and gores a human being? That's a terrible thing. When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be clear. So they had to stone animals to death when this happened. And there were some cases where there was the death penalty for people as well, and they would be stoned to death. We're going to look at some of those cases coming up. And you weren't allowed to eat the animal because it had killed a human person created in the image of God. The animal, in a sense, would be guilty of the blood guilt of that person. It wouldn't seem appropriate to then eat this animal as food. You also couldn't take it to a place of sacrifice for it to be sacrificed to God. Just wasn't a possibility. And so this is a good case of the community participating in judgment here. And then we see here the next couple of verses here in chapter 21, verses 29 to 32. It says, if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, in other words, if there's a prior record that this ox has, and its owner has been warned but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. If a ransom is laid on him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is laid upon him. So essentially, this person who owned the animal should have been responsible, given its past, given its violent tendencies in the past, to make sure, put up a fence around this animal so that it doesn't hurt anyone else. And as we talked about last time, it's a little bit like laws concerning pit bulls that exist in some states and in some countries, because of the fact that many innocent persons, including children, have been killed by those and other animals that have gone awry and had been let loose when they were a danger, potentially to the community around them. Now, so in this case, in ancient Israel, if this happens, if there's a repeat offender animal and it hurts someone and it kills someone, in fact, not only is the animal killed, but the owner should also be put to death. However, he can get out of it if he pays the ransom, a fee, if you will, to get him out of this penalty. Now, it doesn't specify what that fee is, how much it would be, but it is possible for him to escape the death penalty. What's also intriguing is what we see in the next little bit here in verse 31. It says, if it gores, this is the renegade animal again, if it gores a man's son or daughter, he shall be dealt with according to this same rule. If the ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. Now, it's interesting about verse 31, the death of children as a result of this renegade ox. Children are given the same legal status as adults. If something happens to them, it's just as grave as if an adult had been killed. And Thomas Dozeman mentions this in his commentary. It's important for you to know that it wasn't always the case in the ancient world that children were treated as having equal status. Now, we talked about, in the last episode, we talked about the case of a pregnant woman being injured and miscarrying, perhaps. In the ancient world, children were not considered in many cultures, including in the Roman Empire, as being of any value, really, because they weren't old enough to work or be productive members of society. There are any number of reasons. This is why when Jesus takes time to minister to children, people are upset with him, including some of his own apostles, saying he doesn't have time for this. These kids are not important. Jesus has better things to do. He's got a mission to fulfill. But then Jesus turns the tables on that whole discussion, and he puts a child in the midst of them and says, no, actually, the child here, being childlike, this is the ideal condition for being a disciple. This concept of childlike trust, just as a child implicitly trusts his or her parents, you must have that kind of trust in your Father God. And all of this kind of looks forward to, for example, the teaching of St. Thérèse of Lisieux, who talks about spiritual childhood. She talked about it being an elevator to heaven, just as a child might be lifted up in the arms of his father and lifted up high. Spiritual childhood is a way to get very quickly lifted up to the Heavenly Father. It's like an elevator, a high-speed elevator, if you will. And all this kind of goes back to its roots in the Old Testament. The value of the life of a child was on the same level. So that's an interesting thing for us to know here. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. All right, let's go to the next section here. We're really going to speed things up here. But let's go to chapter 22, and we'll just read the first few verses here. There's going to be seven laws here, and they're going to be tied together by a certain word. So let's just read the first few verses here. This is chapter 22, verses 1, 2, 3, and 4. It says, if a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. He shall make restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the stolen beast is found alive in his possession, whether it is an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. If a thief is found breaking in, and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. But if the sun has risen upon him, there shall be blood guilt for him. When a man causes a field or vineyard to be grazed over, or lets his beast loose and it feeds in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best in his own field and in his own vineyard. When fire breaks out and catches in thorns, so that the stacked grain or the standing grain of the field is consumed, he that kindled the fire shall make full restitution. All right, let's stop right there. I actually went a little bit further than I planned. I read right up to verse 6 in chapter 22. But here's what's going on here. When you look at the laws here in chapter 22, they're tied together by a verb that keeps popping up again and again in the original Hebrew text. And the verb means to repay, to repay, to repay. Now, what is going on here? This is all about restitution. Restitution. Understand that the laws in ancient Israel are not the same as what you see in the United States of America in the 21st century. There is no incarceration. There are not laws centered around incarceration. It's about restitution. It's a different kind of justice. So in ancient Israel, there were no supermax prisons that were going to be built for perpetrators. Plus, they were on the move. They were going to be traveling to the promised land. And you couldn't just send these criminals to the Phantom Zone. How did you deal with it? You dealt with things, you dealt with crimes through the process of restitution. And this encapsulates, of course, the lex talionis, the retribution laws, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, all that stuff. And sometimes people had to pay with their lives for what they had done. But there is always restitution. And we see this being played out here in chapter 22. All right, so this first little section here in the first four verses is intriguing. It starts off by saying, when a person steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he shall pay five oxen for an ox and four sheep for a sheep. He shall make restitution. So that's a pretty big penalty there. If you're caught, if you stole an ox, you got to pay back five oxen. That's a five-for-one swap. So you really need to think twice before committing a crime of this nature. Four sheep for every sheep that is stolen. And these are very valuable commodities because in this agrarian environment, you needed these animals to work the land. They were served as food as well, of course, and clothing in many ways. Think of sheep being sheared. Now, what if the person doesn't have the means to pay back? I'm poor, I'm broke, that's why I'm stealing. It says this, if he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. So in other words, this is this common type of slavery in ancient Israel and in the ancient world in general. Indentured servitude was part of it. There was brutal slavery as well, like the Israelites themselves experienced in Egypt, but we're talking about indentured servitude. He's going to have to pay off this debt. He's going to have to pay it back somehow. So then we have here, in the next little section here, verse 4, if the stolen beast is found alive in his possession, whether it is an ox or a donkey or sheep, he shall pay double. So if the animal's still alive and it's recovered, then he still has to pay restitution, but it's not as bad. He has to pay double. Now, this next one might make you remember something that maybe your mom or dad told you when you were growing up. Nothing good ever happens after 11 p.m. And that is almost always the case. I have good friends and family members who are police officers, and they'll say that. Crazy things happen in the middle of the night. Yeah, there's some people who work late and they're coming home, but generally speaking, other than those folks, what's happening late at night is usually not good. It's usually not good. And so this is what's described here in the next little section, where it says, if a thief, this is in verse 2 of, excuse me, this is in verse, yeah, verse 2, excuse me, of chapter 22. If a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. Now, what's being said there? If a thief breaks into your house in the middle of the night and there's a confrontation, you kill this person trying to defend your home, your property, your family, whatever it may be, then you will not have to die. You don't have to assume the death penalty here for killing this person. But then it says something really intriguing in the next verse. In verse 3, it says, if the sun has risen upon him, there shall be blood guilt for him. What's it saying there? It's saying that if somebody breaks into your house in the daytime and you kill this person, then guess what? That's not okay. You actually will have to die as well for taking his life. Now that, to some, might not seem fair, but what's going on here? What's really being said here? Well, if somebody breaks into your house at night, in all likelihood, let's face it, the intent is nefarious. He's trying to steal from you without you noticing because you're asleep. Maybe do something else that's also evil. You might wake up and you might hear this person and you're disoriented. You can't see. It's dark. You might grab a weapon. An ensuing struggle might take place. And you might use lethal force to try to eliminate, negate the threat. But here's the thing. Here's why it's different in the daytime. If it's in the middle of the day and somebody's on your property illicitly, maybe you can't just kill this person, because sometimes somebody being on your property during the daytime, that's not necessarily for nefarious means. It might be the guy checking the gas meter. It might be somebody who has other legitimate business on your property. Perhaps he's trying to fix a fence in your sheep pen. You don't know what part of a work crew. Plus, the other thing too, you could call for help. Ostensibly, there are other people awake. You could call for backup. There are other family members around. There were these family compounds that happened in ancient Israel. People lived in groups. You might call a neighbor, help. What's going on? Might be able to ID this person, because in all likelihood, whoever's on your property is also part of the community. And back then, remember, this community justice idea, everybody knew everybody. It's like growing up in a small town in middle America in the 1950s. Everybody knows everybody. And so it's not the same situation at all if you kill a person who's on your property in the daytime. Now, a little spiritual extrapolation for you here of this principle. Generally speaking, the more light you have been given, the greater the responsibility that you have, because you can see. You can't claim that you can't see if you've been given the light. Now, when it comes to our faith, all of us know a little something about God, even those who are irreligious, so to speak, even those who are not explicitly Catholics, they do know something about God. And St. Paul talks about this in Romans chapter 1. Just from the very creation, from natural law, from your conscience, you do know some things about God, about reality. Now, the question is, are you going to be obedient to the light, or are you going to seek to snuff it out? Are you going to draw the blinds? And so those who have more light and they respond positively to the light, they walk toward the light, they're going to get more light. Just like in the world, not everybody gets as much sunlight as the people living near the equator. They get to sit on the beach and get a nice tan. If you're in Greenland, it's a little bit more tricky, and you got to take advantage of the light that you have. Jesus said in the gospel a couple of things along these lines we really need to pay attention to. He said, the servant that knew his master's will and didn't do it will be beaten with many blows. But the servant who didn't know his master's will and he didn't do it will be beaten with few blows. And this is really about our culpability, about the things of God, the law of God, the teaching of God. Did we adhere to it? Did we live it out? Did we act on the knowledge that we had or not? Jesus says also, to whoever much has been given, much will be demanded. So we have to be responsible for what we know. But don't kid yourself. Ignorance is not bliss. If you think, wow, I'm responsible for what I know, I'm going to be judged on this. Did I live up to what I've been taught, what I knew about the Lord? Don't think that, well, I wish I'd never been taught this, because what you don't know can still hurt you. You're still living against reality if you're not being obedient to the laws of God, the teaching, the gospel of Jesus Christ. This is the truth that sets us free. It's the law of love. And this is, again, the ultimate point of all of these directives in ancient Israel. This is love in action in the community. It's really exciting. I hope you're enjoying this. I know that I am. We'll have much more on this in the next episode of The Faith Explained, but you know what time it is. It's time to dip into the Q&A mailbag right here on The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. Let's do it. Okay, in our question and answer segment today, I'm going to open up an email from Todd G., who emailed me, and he said, "Hi, Kale," and he actually spelled my name K-A-O. K-O, I have been called worse, but hey, I know who you're talking to. He says, "Hi, Kale, I'm a devoted listener to Relevant Radio and a lifelong Catholic." Just a typo, I know it's not intentional. He says, "My wife was Protestant but became Catholic when we got married. I struggle greatly with my two daughters and wife when they don't go to church. When they don't go to communion, when they do go to church, they don't go to confession, and they have this attitude that if they don't do anything wrong, they are fine and will go to heaven. My wife doesn't support me when I push the envelope with the kids. It doesn't work when I try to strong-arm things. Do you have any suggestions or resources on how I can take steps incrementally to convert them to a stronger faith? Thanks so much, Todd G." Hey, Todd, thank you so much for that email. Really appreciate you writing in. It's a really good question. And here's how I would respond to this. It's interesting that you say that your wife did convert to Catholicism when you got married. Now, there's a lot of information that I don't have here. I'm hoping that her conversion was sincere. And obviously you have two daughters. I don't know how old they are. I don't know how old your daughters are. I think that would affect the advice I would give as well. So I'll try to give two different scenarios here. One, when the children are older, sort of they've reached the age of accountability, responsibility for themselves when it comes to the faith, and a situation in which the kids are younger. So they don't go to church, they don't go to communion when they do go, they don't go to confession, and they have this attitude that if they don't do anything wrong, they're fine and will go to heaven. Well, I would say they're already doing a few things that are wrong. They're not obeying the precepts, the five precepts of the church. And it's a mortal sin not to go to Mass on Sundays and holy days of obligation unless you have a grave reason, a very serious reason not to do so. And so I'll get into that in just a second in terms of the precepts of the church. But here's what I would do if I were you. And this, take it with a grain of salt. This is my two cents. I'm not an oracle, and this may not be perfect advice, but this is what I would do if I were you. I would say that you should, if your kids are younger and you are responsible for them at this point, especially in terms of their faith formation, you should sit down with your wife and try to reach some sort of a compromise so that at least they can obey the bare minimum precepts of the church, which I'll tell you what those are in just a moment. And I think that that's what you need to do, because this is your responsibility as a Catholic parent. First of all, I'd say the strong-arming tactics, when you say, like, I've tried to strong-arm them into going and it hasn't worked, I would abandon that modus operandi altogether. I would definitely not try to strong-arm them into going at all. I don't think that's the right approach here at all. I would say that tell your wife, it would mean a lot to me if we could at least go together on these occasions, at least on these minimum occasions. And that may be that opening of grace, opening the door to grace that they might need to receive that when they're older. Now, if they are older, they're responsible for their own souls at that point, and you've done the best that you can do. Your wife obviously is an adult. She's well beyond the age of reason here. You can't strong arm her. And the same would be true of your children. If they are of age, if they're old enough that they can make their own decision about this. But again, what you can do here in that case, if they're older, is set the example yourself. Live out the faith as best you can before them. Pray for them. Never stop praying for them. And keep the lines of communication open so that if they ever do want to return to a practice of the faith, if they ever do want to talk about spiritual issues, that they know that you're going to be there for them, that you're going to be there for them. It's all about building bridges here. Relationships are about bridges. And you try to drive the gospel, you know, the truck of the gospel, the truck filled with truth across that bridge from one person to another. Well, don't blow the bridge. Keep those lines of communication open. And I have a good friend who's a very faithful Catholic. He has 9 children. He's older than me. And he told me that one day, it was actually Christmas morning, his 16-year-old daughter surprised the family by saying, "I'm not going to Mass with you. I don't believe this stuff anymore." And the rest of the kids were in the car. They're all packed in. They're ready to go. And he didn't force her to go. He didn't force her to go, even though she was living under his roof. And he could have. If she's living in his home, he would have had justification perhaps to do that. But he decided not to. He respected her decision. And she still hasn't come back to church. That was about 10 years ago. But the lines of communication are open. She's open to talking about the faith with him. And they often do. When they get together, he'll meet up with her for coffee or lunch, and they'll talk. And the faith is not off the table. And you have to keep praying. You have to keep praying that the seeds that you planted when they were young will take root. And one of the things that I would say is pray that someone else might come into their lives who they will listen to. If they're not listening to you, do what St. Monica did. She prayed for her son, St. Augustine, and eventually God brought Ambrose into his life. St. Ambrose, the bishop. And St. Augustine really, he wasn't a saint at the time, but he really respected Ambrose, and he listened to him in a way that he didn't listen to his mom. He had kind of tuned out Monica at that point. So pray for someone else to come into your children's lives, your wife's life even, who they will listen to. And you'll be surprised how often those prayers are answered. And in terms of resources, one good one is from my colleague here at Relevant Radio. Patrick Madrid has written a book called Search and Rescue, How to Bring Friends, Family into or Back into the Catholic Faith. There's lots of good tips there in that book, and I highly recommend you picking up a copy. All right, if anybody else listening has a question, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me. The address is faith@relevantradio.com, faith@relevantradio.com. And you can also get your question to me on Twitter at Cale Clark. That's my Twitter handle, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Love to hear from you there as well. And we'll catch you later today on The Cale Clark Show at 5 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio, and in the next episode of The Faith Explained, 12:30 Central tomorrow, or anytime on the podcast, relevantradio.com. Share it with a friend through the app as well. God bless you. Take care. Peace.